If it's nerdy, we're into it.
Gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. We are Kyle Eckert and Chris Heck, two lifelong friends with a passion for the world of geekery.
And this is the Geek Ketchup Podcast.
What's good, Geek Ketchup family? I'm Kyle Eckert.
And I'm Chris Heck.
And you are listening to Season 2, Chapter 27. This is Part 2 of our discussion on the recent Marvel's X-Men 10 of Swords or X of Swords crossover event. We're going to take a moment, as always, to say thank you for listening and to send our appreciation your way for spending your time with us. If you've enjoyed Geek Ketchup, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and help us spread the love for the world of geekery. Please share us with your friends and family. Be sure to follow us on social media, Geek Ketchup Podcast on Facebook and YouTube, at Geek Ketchup Pod on Instagram and Twitter. All the links to these accounts are available on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. There's even a link to our Patreon page if you'd like to support the show. This chapter marks a special moment for Chris and I because it's the end of an era. That era being the Dawn of X, the overarching name that has encompassed all X-Men and mutant-related comics Marvel has been publishing for the past year or so. Dating back to Chapter 1 of Geek Ketchup, Chris and I have been reading and breaking down the various comics that have relaunched during the Dawn of X. For a complete recap, make sure to give Chapters 1, 8, 13, 18, and 26 a listen. However, if you're short on time, I'll get you up to speed. The Dawn of X kicked off with a dual series event, House of X and Powers of X. That event established new norms for all mutants, bringing them together as one country and culture on the living island of Krakoa. It was during this time that despite many challenges and setbacks, both internally and externally, mutants began to prosper, building a better life for themselves and future mutants. Then enter the forces of Amenth, an ancient dark army from the depths of Otherworld, led by Annihilation, who threatened everything. This army had attacked once before, many millennia ago, but were fought off by none other than Apocalypse and his original Four Horsemen. Apocalypse's forces were able to push the Dark Army back through the void in which they came, but at a heavy cost. He lost his wife, along with his children, who were trapped on the other side. Now with the army pressing for another invasion, Omniversal Magistrix of Otherworld, Opal Saturnine, seizes the opportunity to play Puppet Master and establishes a set of rules for the invading army and Earth's mutants to determine the final outcome. A tournament of sorts. Think Mortal Kombat, but with your favorite mutants. In part one of our Ten of Swords breakdown, Chris and I covered up until about the halfway mark of this 22-issue event. We saw the rules of the tournament unfold with both sides having 10 representatives named. Then each of these fighters was quested with obtaining a sword or swords to be used during the competition. Just a heads up, we will be talking spoilers for Ten of Swords and the 9 different series that make it up. Those 9 include X-Force, X-Factor, Marauders, Hellions, Cable, New Mutants, Wolverine, Excalibur, and X-Men. So we'll pick things right up where we left off, breaking down Part 12, which was X-Men 14. And as we pick up where we left off, so does Part 12. Apocalypse has just found out that the leader of the opposing forces is in fact his wife, Genesis. They meet for a little midnight stroll, and then the reader gets the history of Arako and the fallen world of Amenth. It starts off with the things that we know, the Twilight Sword breaking through the barriers, cutting the land of Akara into two. The Dark Forces charge through, Apocalypse and company battle them back, and drive the army back through the void. Genesis and her children, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, follow the army to the other side, while Apocalypse remains on Earth. That's what we know. Then we get the full story of what happened on the other side. Some parts we knew, some parts we did not. We did know that for generations, the battle against the forces of Amenth raged, with Genesis and the original Four Horsemen and the other mutants on that side claiming victory in each battle, but in reality, it was about survival, it wasn't about winning, because those forces would never truly stop coming. So the decision was made to ride out, to push back against these forces. However, that ended poorly because they came into an area controlled by the White Sword. At one point, he was an ally fighting against the forces of Amenth, but here, he actually decided to fight against the mutants, and it's where they saw their very first loss. They had this loss, and they were crippled, and with very few options left, Genesis, persuaded by her sister Issaca, went to parley with Annihilation. Of course, upon meeting the leader of the Amoneth forces, Genesis realizes that they had been converting all of those lost mutants over the years into this dark army. And eventually, as these things do, it ended in a duel. Genesis ends up winning this duel, but just like everything in Otherworld, it came with a price. And that's when she realized that by winning the duel and beating Annihilation, she was forced to become Annihilation. She had to put on the helm. This turns the tides of wars, because for a long time, Genesis refused to put on the helm, but she also had to sit by and watch all of her people get slaughtered over and over, and eventually she gives in and dons the helm to kind of save herself and save her fellow mutants. But of course, this triggers the Four Horsemen and remaining mutants to surrender, ending the generations of battle. So Chris, like, a ton went on here. I know that I just had to spill out so much. So I'm going to have you come in, give us your thoughts on this just kind of crazy history that we got bits and pieces of before, but now we're finally getting the full set.
Yeah, it was a great way to kick off the second half of this event. And for me, I thought that it immediately rejuvenated myself, you know, reading through, because we talked about in part one how, you know, issues 1-11 had some highlights, but they weren't as, you know, much of the wow factor that we were expecting. It wasn't quite maybe living up to the hype that we were expecting going into it, though there were, you know, certain things we liked about it, you know, with the tournament and some of that kind of stuff. So once you picked up X-Men 14, you start to get some more different looks out of Apocalypse at the beginning, where he's, you know, walking through the garden, he's looking for peace, he's kind of solemn, he's taking everything in that he's learning and, you know, seeing his wife. And then they jump right into them kind of strolling through the park, essentially, and she's filling him in on all the details of what's been going on. And it really was powerful. I mean, we see a lot of great panels in this issue. We get tons of information, and it really shows the stark contrast between, you know, what Genesis and the mutants of Araco were dealing with and experiencing, which was a lot of desperation. You said survival. That was a great way to put it. You know, lots of pain and anger and, you know, all of the bad.
Yeah.
While Apocalypse, and granted, you know, he had some bad times of his own throughout the history. It's not like he was just living on Krakoa, you know, hanging out on the beach, drinking Coronas the whole time. But the more recent period of time for the mutants has been more peaceful, more prosperous. They've not had as much pain. It hasn't been as dark and bleak. And so it kind of painted this two differences between the two factions and how one was really cultivated and just completely sharpened for this war, for this conflict, whereas the others might be, you know, a little bit softer.
Right. Yeah. It's not anything to say that the Krakoan side has had a more peaceful life, which is crazy if you think about the history of mutants on Earth. It has not been an easy go.
Right.
But by comparison, and the Iraqi forces, like, that's totally different in that side. The other thing that was very interesting to me is that the helm is what appears to be driving this conflict.
Right.
It's not necessarily Genesis or even the forces. It's the helm of Annihilation that is pushing Genesis to do this and to take over the lands. I thought that was a very interesting twist, kind of puts things into perspective, because Apocalypse is happy to see his wife and wants to spend time with his wife. And by everything I can see, she wants to spend time with him.
Right.
But the true piece of the conflict is the helm of Annihilation.
Yeah, it's definitely established really as its own character here.
Yeah.
And the fact that it, you know, is something that is passed on, you know, whoever defeats the current wearer or current owner of the helm, you know, ultimately takes it. But we start to see the personality of the helm come out here in this issue and throughout the rest of the event. And I thought that was really cool. You get to see a lot of the power, you know, some of the panels we saw in this issue of Amenth itself really kind of took it to another level of, you know, how established this world was and how, you know, kind of horrifying it is at the same time. But, you know, when Genesis goes to the capital city to parlay with Annihilation at the time, you know, we get to see how big and established that city is in a few panels. And then we get that awesome fight at the end. So I thought that there was a lot of, you know, really kind of little details that filled in the gaps that we hadn't seen yet. You know, even going back to when Araco and Summoner first showed up before this event, you know, in some of the X-Men issues, we were getting like all these little tidbits, but nothing that you could really sink into. And this issue gave it to us. Probably the only other thing I really wanted to call out here that I thought was interesting was that there were a lot more similarities, I thought, between the two factions of mutants than maybe they even realize. And, you know, we talked about kind of how they both had rough pasts, you know.
Yeah.
Neither had really an easy pathway to get to where we are today. They may just have been slightly different versions of hard.
Right.
But, you know, I thought it was interesting how they showed us that on the Araco side, too, Genesis formed like her own quiet council.
Yeah.
And they didn't call it that, but we see a very similar scene where, you know, they have a council that's trying to run things and handle operations and keep everybody safe, make decisions. And so, you know, it just kind of seemed like they were just parallel universes.
Yeah.
You know, it was like the upside down to the right side up in Stranger Things, where it's the same world, just one's dark and one's a little bit lighter, you know, that kind of stuff. So it got me immediately more excited when we started reading this half of the issues of like, okay, you know, it's picking up.
Things really started to get set in motion. And I love the reference of their own quiet council, because you're right. They did show that, you know, they have their own form of government on this side. And it really plays back into the panel that you had said you really enjoyed in the first half with the mirroring images of the champions
right
through the glass. And it's really showing that these are really two halves of the same coin. They just were dealt different hands, and that's why they've taken shape the way they have.
Yeah, that's a great callback, because I love that panel in the first half of the event. And so that does kind of tie it in here. So I'm glad you called that out.
Yes, and once again, we'll move on to part 13 here, but before we jump there, Jonathan Hickman, Lionel Yu, and Ashar doing the art. The one thing that we've kind of skipped over in our breakdowns here is really getting into the art in itself in each of these books, and it's phenomenal. Like the story's so good, it's really easy to look over it, but like you said, the details of what this world looks like after generations of war and the various mutations that have happened is really well done. So shout out to Hickman and Co., you know, for developing this world and really bringing it to life with the art.
Well, and doing it with multiple writers and a good handful of more of artists. You know, I think through the whole 22 issues, there was only one or two that had a styling that I really didn't like,
yeah,
or enjoy as much. You know, everything else was fantastic. And since you brought it up, I'll go ahead and give the shout out, because I know I had it written down for the final issue, but anything that Pepe Larraz does,
yeah,
I'm just on board with. I have found that I really, really like his art and the intensity and the styling. It just fits. I don't know. It's kind of modern, but
yeah,
I don't know. All around, I've really, really enjoyed that aspect of it, and his particularly.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But we'll jump in here to Marauders number 14, which is part 13 of the X of Swords, 10 of Swords event. This one was pretty cool, because I felt like for me, it was a bit of a throwback to X-Men number 4, I believe, with the dinner.
Yeah.
When the Krakoan government went to meet with all of the other governments, all human governments, and they sat down and had a dinner. This one was very similar. Saturnine hosts a dinner the night before the tournament begins. All the competitors were there. All the representatives from the various lands of Otherworld that are going to play host to the battles, they were there. Everyone was invited to mingle. And there were a lot of really good interactions in this issue.
This issue was fantastic. And again, I got to give another shout out, because if Pepe Larraz was my favorite artist, I think that at least with these Marauders issues, Stefano Caselli was my second favorite. Like,
yeah,
these were fantastic as well. And this issue was right up my alley for a number of reasons, because A, you get to see the characters in some different ways, you know, getting to see them interact with their enemies essentially is always, yeah, interesting. And, you know, so many of the X-Men personalities are so different and strong in their own ways. But then you also have the Araco champions that are very strong and intense and unique, you know, kind of weirdos in their own ways.
Yeah.
So just like throwing them all together in this, you know, in this party, you knew you were going to get some odd stuff. But I have to give a shout out. This literally is one of the highlights of the entire series for me, just being a food guy. This issue opened with a info panel, essentially,
yeah,
which was the menu that they got, and I couldn't look past it. And so I'm not going to go through all of it, but it was a 5-course dinner, you know, very, very high-end, very fancy. And we saw Saturnine and Jay Jaspers from the Crooked Market essentially bringing in all these top-shelf ingredients and liquors, rarities,
yeah,
decadence, you know, indulgences from all of the worlds. And so that, of course, came with some really, really weird shit,
yeah,
just to be honest. And so I wrote down a couple of dishes just to give the listeners a little bit of an example here. But it started off with an amuse-bouche of ghost fig dry-aged in the Crooked Market during the devil winds that were flowing from Blightspoke.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have multiple worlds coming together to make this amazing starter. It moved on to things like a sea leaf salad that was harvested from the Shadow Trench and braised in the urine of Orchina, the giant squid. So if you ever wondered what, you know, essentially collard greens braised in urine would taste like, go talk to Logan because he knows now. That was one of the signature dishes here. And then finally, because everybody likes dessert, I thought that this was kind of funny, but it was chilled creme of Neptune's glaciers. Think of that what you will.
Right.
With honey drizzled fairy wings. So a little bit of a magical dessert there to,
yeah,
you know, just cleanse the palate at the end. So that had me laughing right off the bat. And I was like, let's go. I'm ready to get into this dinner party.
It was pretty cool. And shout out to the fourth course, which was the Horned Beast, where they all got to eat unicorn.
Unicorn, yeah.
They got to eat unicorn meat. And that was very entertaining. But there were so many just fantastic interactions in this whole issue. And it's funny because some of the best issues are the ones with no real action.
Right.
And it's all, you know, political and intrigue conversations. I thought some of the highlights in this issue for me were Magic and Gorgons basically sizing up the competition.
Yeah.
Looking around, trying to find weaknesses. Mainly they were focusing on Iska, the Unbeaten.
Right.
And trying to find a way, you know, a weakness of hers. And of course they found out she has none.
They were trying to determine, you know, which hands, you know, each of the warriors favored. Are they left-handed? Are they right-handed? They had this cool trick that they were doing where they were walking around with their champagne glasses and like dropping them on accident, but actually on purpose in front of the competitors to see which hands they would use to grab it and stuff like that. But Iska was clearly on to the trick because she was doing the same thing. And so there was a great little tit for tat between them, you know, as they each tried to determine which hands they favored and get that upper hand. But Iska was just like, you know what? I would have just told you if you asked.
Yeah, right.
Because she did not care. She is confident to the max.
It really kind of plays into it where these other mutants on the Iraqi side of things they're very nice. They're very civil. You know, so for the most part, there's a few like war who really is like, why are we doing this? We should just murder them.
Yeah.
But some of the others, you know, are very polite and they want to get to know the other mutants on the other side. And they understand they're in a competition, but it's this respect level to some extent.
Well, and the other thing we see here is not just, you know, some of the tensions between the two different sides, but we actually see some different tensions between the sides themselves. So,
yeah,
you know, you have these tensions continuing on between the White Sword and War, you know, and the Four Horsemen. We see Wolverine call out Brian Braddock for essentially, you know, being the cause of all this, because Wolverine knows that all Saturnine wants is a piece of Brian for herself.
Yeah.
And so, like, he's kind of getting drunk and he's like, straight up, you're not pulling your weight.
Yeah.
This is on you. If you would just give Saturnine what she clearly wants, this could all be over, Brian.
Right.
But he won't do it because he's such a man of honor and he's married on Earth, you know, so he's got to keep up his vows. But I thought that kind of stuff was really funny. And ultimately, actually, some of the best art in this issue and one of the best moments from this dinner scene was when Storm and Death interact.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have that marked down. The Storm and Death, like, dance. They basically, you know, Death takes Storm's hand and they go out and take center stage on the dance floor, which is premier.
Yeah.
That honestly, I have a variant cover that is actually Storm and Death kind of doing a little bit of a tango.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
And so maybe the cover gave it away that was going to happen before I read it. But that was my favorite moment of this because it's almost like a taste of things to come.
Yeah, they're courting each other. It's almost like Death's kind of in love with her at a glance or has been chasing her. And she's, of course, kind of brushed with Death over her entire life and her background and, you know, always kind of escaped him. And so it was cool because you had these very literal interpretations of what I just explained, right? You know, if you think about the cliches of escaping death or chasing death and things like that, you know, that's ingrained in our lives.
Sure.
And it gets illustrated in different ways through books and movies and things like that. And I just thought that this was another great version of those types of things, of them just kind of flirting together. And Death, you know, is pretty much saying, you know, that she wants it, he's going after her. He's laying the game on hard, you know, essentially.
Yeah.
And I thought that at the end it was really cool because she went on to say something like, you know, she neither fears or desires Death, but she knows him.
Yeah.
And that because of her experiences, this dance with Death is as close as she'll ever get.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
So I thought that there were some really cool things there. She's also kind of saying that she doesn't fear him, you know, like she welcomes it if it happens, but she's not ready for it.
Yeah. Well, and then there's a moment, I believe, War or Pestilence, it says, like, these mutants reek of fear and death. And Death corrects her and says, not this one.
Yeah.
This one is not fear. It's not fear you're smelling because she doesn't fear us.
Yeah.
You know, one more, which is a nice little notch to Storm because she is a badass, you know, in her own right. So just kind of props that up a little more.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much every page of this issue I enjoyed. I mean, there's probably more here than we could even call out for the purposes of this. But it once again, it just took, you know, what issue 12 did and kept building on it. And so my excitement with the event just kept notching up at this point.
Well, and then this issue leads directly into the next issue, which is Marauders 15, which is unique for this event. We actually had back-to-back issues that were the same series.
Right.
So same writing combo of Jerry Duggan and Benjamin Percy. And of course, you know, we already talked about the art coming from Stefano in his own right. And so it continues right into Marauders 15, part 14 of the overall event. And at the end of 13... we get a twist. Logan gets drunk and basically confronts Saturnine.
Yes.
Stabs her through the heart. Tries to kill her. And we're like, that's how the cliffhanger ends. But the very next issue kicks off with a completely destroyed Earth.
I have to say that end to that issue was epic. And I did not quite see it coming, you know, going to that level. And so it was a great cliffhanger, even though I was able to jump right into the next book because of how we read this. Like, it was this, oh my God, like, what just happened?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I immediately had to pick up Marauders 15 and jump right into it because it's just like, you know, after reading Excalibur and you see everything with Saturnine and you realize how powerful she is, how legit she is, you know, that moment right there was either going to change the entire event completely, or it was just going to have serious impacts into the world, you know, one way or another, or even for Logan. So I was like, oh, let's go.
Yeah.
Jump right into the next book.
I expected it to just turn into chaos. And
yes.
As the next issue kicks off, it is chaos. It's a completely destroyed Earth, scenes from all around the Marvel Universe, and kind of showing how this dark army has leveled everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, we see Wolverine, who's been strung up to just sit and watch.
Yep.
And as his entire world gets torn around him because he made this decision to kill Saturnine, which forfeited the tournament on their side. But unfortunately, it is a dream or hallucination because then you see Saturnine come up and she's pulled this over his eyes, and she realizes that he was planning to assassinate her, doesn't let it go. So then it all snaps right back into the dinner party, and this issue continues the dinner party. But what should have been a forfeit ends up not being a forfeit, because War in all of this also attempted to poison Wolverine and inadvertently poison Cypher.
Yeah, they both tried to cheat, essentially.
So, yeah, it ends up being even, while you would think, all right, well, because they said all along, Wolverine, if you get caught doing this, it's an instant forfeit.
Right.
And he understands the risks. And I think in his conversations with Storm before this happened, she said, don't miss.
Yeah.
Like, that's the big thing. Don't miss. If you're going to do this, you need to make sure that, you know, don't come at the king, you know, if you're going to miss, basically.
Yeah.
And so he did miss, should have been a forfeit, but War attempts to poison him. My favorite part of this is the White Sword is just disgusted, you know, because basically Doug gets poisoned and dies in front of everyone at this. And the White Sword is just disgusted that they would low blow to a poison to end this conflict. So he revives Doug using his mutant ability. Revives Doug and then releases him instantly from the oath that Cypher would have had, you know, from being resurrected. And the dinner just continues as planned, which is very humorous to me, to some, like, all these crazy hallucination deaths and poisonings and Doug, like, dramatically dying on the floor, only to just, nope, reverse all of it. Dinner continues.
Yeah, it was a cool way to do and tell the story, because it kind of took you through these ups and downs of, like, you know, the roller coaster of emotions from when, you know, when Wolverine kills Saturnine to opening with such destruction and, like, all hope is lost, complete apocalyptic, you know, end times kind of scenario for Earth and the mutants of Krakoa. Then we're right back to just normal life, and the party's going on, the champagne's back out, now we've got Cypher dead. It was really just a crazy roller coaster through, you know, a good probably 15 or 20 pages of storytelling, and I thought it really made the White Sword even that much more interesting, because he's clearly got such a strict, you know, moral code, and he's very kind of like old school knightish, if you think about, you know, honor and all of that that goes with it. You always fight fair and fight clean, things like that. But I also thought that it really highlighted even more, and this is a theme with Opal Saturnine. You can take all the way back to Excalibur, where she first started getting mentioned. And every time we see her, she's kind of showing off some more abilities.
Yeah.
And she's showing off that she's more powerful than you think.
Yeah.
And even something like this, to think about how you've got, you know, some of the most powerful creatures in the entire universe, you know, all the worlds are right here with her, and it almost doesn't even matter, because at the snap of a finger or the whim of a thought, she can completely control everything that they are doing, everything that's going on in time, and it just really kept expanding on that for me when it comes to her.
Oh yeah,
you know, she saw all of this coming and had answers for it all, essentially.
When it keeps playing back into this theme that she is the puppet master,
yes,
you know, that they're all playing a game that she is controlling. So as much as they think they're contributing, they're not. She is controlling everyone's every move. So it's pretty cool. She is super powerful, but ultimately, the dinner moves on. One of the highlights of this issue on the dinner is Apocalypse and Genesis just kind of sitting by,
right,
watching all the dramatics play out. And they just don't care, because they're both millennia old and have seen it all.
Yeah.
And don't care for, like, the theatrics and the drama. They just want to sit, eat in peace, and then get to the fighting tomorrow.
Well, and I think that they're the only two, at least from the combatants' standpoint, that are resigned to the fact that all of this is fated.
Yeah.
And most any time we see either of these characters throughout all these issues, it's all talking about how this is fate. And even going back into the Excalibur issues, like 1 through 12 before the event, especially towards the end where we started getting info pages out of, like, Apocalypse's memoirs and things like that, he has known what is coming for 10,000 years. And so I think that's one reason why we see the calm in them, is that they know that kind of no matter what's going on, it's already preordained. The outcome is already determined. They just have to go through the motions. So, like, why get worked up at a dinner party, you know?
Yeah.
Why not just enjoy your seaweed salad with the urine of a giant squid, you know?
That's true. That's fair. I didn't think about that. That, you know, they understand that they're being controlled and it's all fate.
Right.
And they'll get there, though, when they get there. Everything's preordained.
But one of the cool things, too, before we move on real quick, that I thought was in here was they had an info page here towards the end where we get to see Jay Jaspers from the Crooked Market, his betting odds.
Yeah.
You know, he's like he's a bookie on the side taking bets on who's going to win these fights. And so I just wrote down a couple of them here because I thought they were interesting just to throw out there before the contest starts. We had Genesis had second to best odds at 3-1. Apocalypse was 5-1. Iska the Unbeaten was the most favorited at 2-1. And then we saw Wolverine and Solemn, both very, very powerful, were at 20-1.
Yeah.
Which I thought was pretty long odds for somebody like Wolverine. Death was 50-1. Storm was 50-1. So they were kind of even. And then we had Cypher at 5,000-1. He was the the longest odds out of all of them. So I thought that they went through all the characters, but I thought that some of those were kind of the most interesting.
Well, and also the White Sword was 6-1.
Oh, yeah, he was pretty high. Yeah.
Yeah, he was high. I thought that was cool to see that he was high. Wolverine was really surprising at 20-1 because so was Gorgon.
Yeah.
Like, Gorgon was also 20-1. And then Captain Avalon and Captain Britain were both 30-1.
Right.
So really looking at it, they're not that far off of Wolverine.
No.
The one big thing I took away from this was the Araco side definitely had the advantage in as far as the betting odds. Like,
for sure.
Not very many Krakoan Earthly Mutants were ranked high other than Apocalypse.
Yeah, they were definitely the underdogs.
But so Chris, as Chris said, near the end of this, it ended with these betting odds, and then the actual end of this issue saw what we finally wanted, what we were itching to get, and it was who was going to be that first fight. Saturnine draws the cards, and we see that it's Betsy Braddock versus Iska the Unbeaten for our very first match.
Yeah, that was a heartbreaker right there. You know, it was almost preordained in its own way, too, but, you know, Iska is the Unbeaten. Her mutant power is she cannot lose. So you immediately feel like that tarot card from, I think it was, you know, issue 10 or 11, where we talked about the foreshadowing when they were all going to their rooms. And Betsy got that Nine of Swords card where, you know, it was her getting stabbed. It's like, oh, is this going to come true?
Yeah, is this going to how it goes down? So we'll jump right into Excalibur 14, which is part 15 of the overall event. True to form with Excalibur, Teenie Howard and Phil Noto on writing and art here. So we kick things off right away in the Kingdom of Avalon, ruled by Betsy's brother, Jamie. This battle is going to take place in a very medieval kind of arena looking spot, and it is a fight to the death. Issica the Unbeaten, Captain Britain, Betsy Braddock. I was hyped at this point.
I was super hyped because it felt like, okay, this is what we're here for. My first thought, though, once I realized that this was going to take place in Avalon, was, okay, well, maybe Betsy's got a shot.
Yeah.
Because King Jamie, Betsy's brother's power, is reality bending.
Right.
He can shape reality to anything he wants, and he's an omega level mutant, and it's his home, you know. He runs this world, like, and so I was thinking, okay, we're gonna get some house rules here from Jamie.
Yeah,
this fight is not going to be as lopsided as expected. And then they get to fighting,
and unfortunately this is over in an instant as Issica takes her sword Mercy and attacks Betsy. I guess it's not right out the gate. Betsy gets a swipe or two in and they square off. But once Iska swipes Mercy, it shatters the Starlight Sword and by extension shatters Betsy into a million pieces, almost like a mosaic, like a stained glass in a church or something like that. And she breaks apart. Saturnine steps up and says, "Fight over, Point Araco." And it's just this, my heart sank.
Yeah, that scene was as shocking as it was cool, because, you know, you're like, damn, Captain Britain is a very, very strong competitor. Betsy has been a very powerful Captain Britain, so you think that this is going to go for at least a couple of pages.
Yeah.
And it barely goes a couple of panels. But yeah. When they shattered her into that, you know, stained glass kind of look, I thought that that was actually just a really cool, unexpected way to go out.
Oh, yeah.
But it's kind of mirrored in some immediate mystery, because the second, you know, Iska shatters her is when Saturnine shows up.
Yeah.
And Saturnine and Betsy are complete rivals right now. It's a stronger rivalry than Bailey and Sasha. You know what I mean? And so it's like you kind of immediately think, wait, did Saturnine just play with this a little bit? Or what happened, you know?
Yeah.
And we ultimately don't know. She has all her people, though, collect the shards of Betsy, like, immediately.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of another thing that just had me going, this wasn't fair from the beginning.
Yeah, well, and Brian calls her out. Like, he immediately charges her and says, yeah, you are playing games. Like, what have you done to my sister? What are you doing, witch? He actually calls her a greedy witch. You're meddling in your own games. So they know, you know, she's pulling the strings from above. She's pulling the strings.
Yeah. And it's funny, because really the other thing with this outcome was that it really set things off to, okay, this is about to get weird.
Mm-hmm.
And up until this point, and even when this fight, I don't know about you, but the expectation was Mortal Kombat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. Was straight up sword fights to the death, Mortal Kombat, very straightforward rules. And like, from this moment on, it flipped it on its head.
Oh, yeah, that is not what we get at all. Because, in fact, as soon as this fight's over, the next duel, I guess you could call it, contest. Is announced. The next contest is the best way to put it, is announced. And it's Cypher against Bay the Blood Moon. And eventually, like, a group of people grab both of them and whisk them away. And the next panel we see, they're both being dressed in, like, robes.
Yeah.
It's almost as if, like, I think Magic comes in and she's talking to Cypher and she says, no, it kind of looks like a dinner more than a duel. And he's real confused. He's also very nervous because Doug is not a fighter. The curtains get pulled back and you find out it's not a contest of fighting. It's a contest that's a wedding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They have to marry each other to win. Or lose. I'm not sure about which. But
right. And Cypher hesitates. Like, everyone's like, you don't have to do it, kid. You don't have to do it. And he's like, no, it's okay. It's okay. Because something that's very interesting about Cypher is his mutant ability to communicate with anything, to instantly pick up languages. But yet, Bay, the Blood Moon, he can't understand. It's the very first being that he's ever come in contact with that he can't understand what they're saying.
Right.
So he's, like, immediately infatuated with her.
Yeah.
And we see that kind of play out throughout the dinner issues, and then even here it gets doubled down on, because he's obviously just head over heels for her with intrigue, and so he agrees, so no, I'll marry her.
Yeah, it was super weird. It was interesting. It was kind of funny at times. It was another kind of harken back to the tarot cards we saw, because for Cypher's card he got the Two of Cups.
Yeah.
And it was him and what looked like Bay in the drawing, I think. It wasn't confirmed, but
right.
That was kind of the insinuation. So, you know, it was just this back and forth that we kept getting of, like, what have we already been told in a straightforward manner, you know, that's coming true kind of literally, versus maybe some other things that aren't nearly as literal at all and are really more of a surprise. So they did a good job kind of bouncing it around, even though I had these initial reactions of, like, wait, are we not going to get what we thought we were going to get?
Right.
You know? And so it just kept the roller coaster going of, like, excitement and disappointment and ups and downs. But we got a cool action scene here. You know, it wasn't Red Wedding level interruption, but we did get a interruption to the ceremony here.
Yeah. Jubilee, who was in mental contact with Betsy before Betsy's duel, crashes the wedding with on Shogo, her giant dragon son.
Baby.
maybe. That part is always because comics. So that's the best way to describe that one.
On Earth, he's a baby, like less than a year old, and it is her actual son. But when they travel to Otherworld, he becomes a giant dragon, green dragon, that can breathe fire that melts reality.
Yeah, so because comics. Yes. So Jubilee crashes the wedding on Shogo because she thinks everyone's in danger.
Mm-hmm.
But immediately, Saturnine takes control of Shogo, and all is resolved. We find out that it's okay. I think Jubilee gets transported away.
Yeah.
She gets teleported away, but Saturnine takes Shogo, and the wedding proceeds as usual, and a point is awarded to each side. So, very interesting, obviously, Jubilee coming in to crash the wedding, Shogo playing his part, getting separated from his mother, Saturnine definitely clearly wants a pet dragon here.
Right.
A lot of little, as Hickman and co. are tend to do, they're planting seeds for later.
Yeah.
So, you feel like something is off here. I think we're going to find out what it is later, but at this point in the story, you don't actually know that. You never know what's going to be important and what's not going to be important.
It's true. It's true. It keeps you on your toes. So immediately, though, out the gate here, we see that the score is already 2-1 for Racco, though.
Yeah. Again, they're getting that lead. They had the betting odds against them, and they're getting that lead. But it brings us to part 16, which is Wolverine number 7. And man, oh man, we said it in the first half, leave it to Wolverine to take everything up a notch.
Yes.
And he did it again here, because this issue picks up the pace big time.
Oh,
because
yeah.
we get to see several contests play out here. And the very first one being Magic traveling to the floating kingdom of Roma Regina for her duel with Pogger Pog.
Was glad to see Pogger Pog go up against Magic, because you could tell from the moment that they had, you know, visibility of each other, or Magic could see this giant T-Rex with arms and everything like that, that she just wanted him.
Yeah.
Like, she had him pegged as the one that she was going to go after, so I expected this to be super cool.
And this one, as with the wedding, came with a bit of a twist. It was not going to be a straightforward duel, but instead it was going to be an arm wrestling contest.
Yeah, which was completely fair.
Yeah.
You know, this monstrosity of a dinosaur with giant Goro arms against, you know, Magic, who is not a little girl in, like, the true sense. You know, she is very, very powerful, but her figure
is
that of a petite woman. And so you're just like, there's no way, you know?
It's like, right.
It'd be like me going up against Scott Steiner in an arm wrestling contest. You know what I mean?
Or more like me going up against Scott Steiner. Like, maybe Billy Kidman. I don't know.
Yeah.
So it ends up being an arm wrestling contest. Pogger Pog kind of cheats. He goes early. They're on a countdown from 3, and it goes 3, 2, 1, and he slams her on 1 and says, I win.
Yep.
Point goes to Arako. Eventually, they're clearly out the gate getting this lead. It's now 3-1. Then we get a break, and we come into Wolverine's duel. As he enters Blightspoke, the realm of collapsed realities, and he is fighting Summoner, the first one to death.
This was freaking epic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So far, fight of the issues, fight of the series. And I actually have to give a really big shout out to the art for the environment of Blightspoke.
Yeah.
I thought that the way they did that was super cool. You know, it's one thing to say that it's the world of collapsed realities, but then to see it, you know, you think about science fiction and, you know, Star Wars and stuff where they're on planets where you're on the ground and you're looking up and there's multiple suns or there's multiple moons and kind of how that feel gives you. Well, here for Blightspoke, it was like that, except for instead of multiple moons, it was like whole galaxies and whole planets and things like that. And so it was just a little bit of a different twist on something that we see. And you start to think, like, what all is here? You know, it was just some questions that I had. And what are these galaxies? What could be made up here? How big is this place? You know?
Because you're right. It's like all different types. There's like a plant-based one. There's one that looks like they're fighting on the surface of the sun. There's another one that's like negative energy, and they're wearing almost Tron-like outfits.
Yeah.
Like, it is crazy. So, yeah, hats off to Joshua Cassara, who did the art on this particular issue of Wolverine. All issues of Wolverine and X-Force are Benjamin Percy and Gary Duggan. They kind of teamed up on a lot of the Marauders Wolverine X-Forces, but the art here, Joshua Cassara, killing it.
Yeah.
Absolutely killing it in this double Wolverine number 7, and then eventually the X-Force number 17 issues.
And so, like, they go pretty much straight from, you know, that initial view of the environment as Wolverine's walking in, and then we see kind of some of the other things come that you were just talking about after Summoner pulls him through the sand, like essentially into the planet, and then they go from there, and you get just two or three of the most wild comic pages I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, think about just like shattered glass on a page, and every little shard is a different version of Summoner versus Wolverine in these different realities. And what Kyle was saying with some of the different environments, you know, that's exactly how it was. Everyone was different. You know, ice and rock. One looked like it was all swarms of spiders. There was one where they were pieces on a chessboard.
Yeah.
You know, one looked like they were Minecraft block people. I mean, like, if you any different form of reality or of Wolverine and Summer that you could think of, they displayed it. I mean, dozens of them across these pages.
And it's almost done. You said stained glass. It's like they spilt paint.
And that too, yeah.
Every little negative space of spilt paint is filled in with a crazy reality.
Yeah.
We've got zombie versions. We've got one where they look like they're literal. Wolverine is an actual Wolverine.
Yeah.
You know, like he's a little animal. Like it is really, truly crazy. And it brings Blightspoke to life, like you said. And it's just really, really well done.
It immediately made me think that I want Blightspoke as an arena for Mortal Kombat, the game.
Yeah.
You know, like just something insane where, like, as you're like punching and kicking it, you just like turn into a different version of yourself or whatever it may be. It just seemed like it would be a really cool environment for a video game, like a fighting game.
Yeah, I'm thinking in Mortal Kombat how you can transition from one arena to the other.
Yes.
If you like punch somebody through a wall, and even if it was just a cinematic of the two characters transitioning between these different realities, turning into different things, it would be super cool.
Yeah, exactly.
But this fight goes on through the different realities, and then Wolverine chucks his sword in this amazing splash panel right through Summoner's eye, and just straight up kills him. So you can see this epic battle play out through the different realities, and then as you turn the page, literally, you just see a sword go through Summoner's eye. He's down for the count. He's dead. But in all of the twists and turns that we've been getting, we get one more twist and turn.
Dirty.
Saturnine gives the point to Araco because she said it's a fight to the death. And Summoner fought to the death first.
Yep. It was whoever died first.
Whoever died first.
Tricky.
And as soon as that one's done, she teleports him, boom, to the very next duel, which is another twist and turn. I'm going to say twist and turn about a million times this chapter because there are so many. The next card is drawn, and it is the Page of Cups. And it's a drinking contest.
Right.
But it's a drinking contest between Wolverine and Storm, who are two on the same side. So that was kind of fun. There wasn't much to it. They both basically compete. They get drunk, and a point is awarded to Krakoa.
Yeah, there was a couple of little things here, though. They said that the liquor that Jasper brought out for them was one of the finest, rarest liquors in all the worlds. And I think Storm, when she takes that first shot to get them started, she said that it tasted like fire and nectar all at once. So it's a very, very special alcohol that they pretty much get to get wasted on.
Yeah, and they do. They proceed to get very, very drunk. And then we jump as the reader over to the Starlight Citadel, where we've gotten a Krakoa versus Krakoa matchup. And at the Starlight Citadel, there's an Araco versus Araco matchup between Solemn and War, and an age-old blood feud, because dating back to our part one discussion, We said that something happened here where they put Solomon in jail, a lover's quarrel, something of that nature. So Solomon and Ward do not like each other, but they realized that they needed Solomon in this contest.
Yeah, and I was immediately thrown back on this one, but then was gearing up expecting it to be just epic because, as we said, you know, Solomon seems like a powerful character. He seems like a very interesting character. And I was probably more excited to see him fight than almost any other character in the entire tournament. But the twists and turns just keep on going because right as they're about to square up, we see Solomon call in Wolverine. And essentially we find out what the price was that Wolverine had to pay to get his Masamura sword. And it was the fact that he had to essentially indenture himself to Solomon to stand in for any fight that Solomon wants. So kind of shows how smart Solomon was, because knowing that, he knew he was going to be in a fight at some point, so he kind of gave himself an ace in the hole to not have to worry about this duel to the death.
Yeah, oh yeah, and he says, bring me my boy. Right before the fight is about to go down, he says, bring me my boy, and a drunk Wolverine gets teleported into the fight with War. He's just wasted. He can't get his bearings down. He doesn't know what's going on, and War's pissed off. She says, this is BS. This isn't fair. Like, my fight is with you. You can't cheat your way out of this. Saturnine kind of autocorrects that a little bit by saying, yes, you have this beef with Solomon over your husband, but this man right here also just killed your son.
Right, yeah. Gave her a little extra rage.
So they end up getting into a battle, a brutal fight, and the winner is determined by first one to sever an appendage from the other. And this fight also is incredibly brutal back and forth, with War getting several big chops into Wolverine. She puts her sword into his neck.
Yeah.
And is about to kill him, or about to, I guess, either cut off his head or cut off his arm. And he pulls out, you know, his claws, hacks off her hand, fight over. And then he stands up as soon as the fight's over and says, somebody get this sword out of my neck.
Yeah, it was an epic fight. It was one of the better ones, too, that we've seen. Not quite to the level of what we got with Summoner and Wolverine, but was still better than, say, like Betsy and Iska.
Yeah.
One thing I think that was important to call out, though, that kind of upped the stakes here, was that once Wolverine got brought in at the beginning of the fight, and he's still hammered from that liquor that came from the Crooked Market, he realizes that he's not getting rid of the alcohol. His body isn't healing.
Right.
He realizes that maybe it's a byproduct of the liquor or whatever it may be, but he's not healing the same. So you kind of have this thought of, well, if Ward takes his head or his arm, he may not recover.
You know, yeah.
He may not be able to grow it back because he doesn't have his powers at full tilt. So he ultimately won here and took her hand, like you said. But I know when this match was starting, I was like, okay, you know, what is about to happen here? Are we going to get a different Wolverine moving forward if something happens? So it was just another one of those little moments that kept changing the stakes, and you had to really stay tuned into some of them as you were reading it, because it was kind of creating a lot of the drama as they move through these different contests.
Yeah, and that's where they were adding, like you said, the drama to the fights. We had these expectations. They got tempered a little bit because we realized it's not just going to be 10 duels to the death.
Right.
But these other little subtle adds to each piece heightens the drama. So, you know, well done to all the writers all around. They're planting these seeds. They're giving you these small details that you could easily overlook, but they all are major factors into the overall story.
Yeah, and what, of course, kind of sucks, though, at the end is that even though Wolverine wins, you know, they came into this contest, and I think the score was Arako 4, Krakoa 2, and so we see, you know, Wolverine step in, but the excitement of him winning kind of gets destroyed immediately because they realize Saturnine says, you know, point Arako, because it was supposed to be Solomon.
Right.
It wasn't Wolverine fighting for Krakoa. He was fighting for Solomon, who was fighting for Arako. So we come out and the gap grows even larger, and it's actually Arako 5, Krakoa 2.
Which is one more thing. Saturnine is playing games. She's playing everyone, making sure that this ends the way that she wants it to end. But we'll jump into X-Force 14, part 17 of the overall event. Same writing team, same art team. So we keep seeing these like continuations, like we saw back-to-back Marauders issues, and now we're getting a Wolverine, then an X-Force, which are two different series, but with the same writing creative team, they do feel like just long two-parters here. And to kick off this issue, we return to the floating kingdom of Roma Regina and get another matchup between Magic and Pogger Pog. Like you said, she had her eye on him. She wanted to fight him.
Yep.
And this was the moment. You know, yeah, she got screwed over with the arm wrestling contest, but this one's going to be a straight-up duel. Takes a bit of a twist. They remove the swords, and it needs to be a fist fight.
Yeah, Saturnine once again tries to screw him over, takes away the swords, which is seemingly Magic's only advantage. But ultimately, she's much smarter than Pogger Pog.
And I noted that here, that this is one of my favorite moments because it shows that not only does Magic have the brawn in these situations, but she has the brains.
Yeah.
Because what she reveals is that she's been clearly paying attention, and she finds out that the word Pog is actually Iraqi for sword. So she pieces together that Pogger Pog is one big sword, which means that the armor and this giant alligator dinosaur look is the sword to a much smaller being on the inside. So she lets Pogger Pog eat her whole, only for her to come bursting out of his stomach,
yep,
kind of like alien style, holding a smaller alien and kind of saying, you either submit or I kill you, but either way, the point is going to Krakoa.
Yeah, he was like a little troll, like a baby Shrek.
Kind of, he was kind of pudgy. He had like a pudgy little belly. Yeah.
Yeah, like a weak being that is using this giant, you know, armor, whatever it may be, body of this T-Rex Goro hybrid, you know, as a mask. And so that was super cool. I've always known about Magic, and of course she's been around for a long time, but she's not a character that I've ever, you know, read a ton on or given a lot of specific attention to. And I do have to call out that in this event, it's really kind of upped her stock for me. Like, she was always kind of cool. She always had good moments. But between seeing some of these deeper levels and her thought process, like you said, getting the brains to go along with the brawn, it's taken her up a little bit on the list of X-Men for me. And I'm kind of interested to see more about her moving forward, maybe more so than I was in the past, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I benefited from reading when she was in Uncanny.
Okay.
Kind of pre where we are right now in Marvel. She was part of the Uncanny X-Men with Cyclops, but now she's in New Mutants. And I think it's just a factor of there's too many comics out there. There's too much to read, so we're not reading New Mutants.
True.
But she would be an absolute highlight to be able to read in New Mutants.
Yeah, for sure.
So we skip on, and then the rest of this issue is where we kind of get the full encompass of what this tournament's going to be, because it's a variety of competitions and both sides get points in all these different competitions. But we see that it's much more than just straightforward duels. We see a torture endurance competition, a swimming competition, an eating, dance, puzzle, navigation, a staring contest, a riddle contest, a seduction contest in which Gorgon basically is about to go have sex with a rock. they have to roll boulders up a hill. The first one to kill a kitten.
The runway walk-off?
The runway walk-off, yeah. We just see a montage of these different competitions. A foot race between Captain Avalon and Red Root of the Forest. Just all sorts of different things play out, and it brings a bit of humor. It's a nice break from the high tension of the actual duels to death.
Yeah, it had me laughing as I read this, because all I could think about was like the 80s movie montage.
Yeah.
Obviously, this wasn't a training battle, but if you think about those types of things, the Karate Kid or whatever, where it's like, you know, cue the, you're the best around, you know, the 80s music montage, and it's just going from scene to scene as they're going through all these things.
Driving their car at night.
Yeah. It just put in full scope that this is not a Mortal Kombat tournament like we thought. It's not even close. It's really much more of a, you know, funhouse of horrors for Saturnine's amusement.
Oh, yeah. And I wrote that down. I said it breaks the mold of the Mortal Kombat tournament that we thought was going to happen. And like you said, disappointment and excitement at the same time. It's kind of a total yaboo where we really wanted to see mutants in a Mortal Kombat style tournament. But this is fun, too. Like, it's not what I was expecting, but it's also been a lot of fun.
It was definitely entertaining, but you had to kind of keep focus as you were going through because, you know, these were literally just thrown at us in a couple of pages, you know, with just each panel being a different contest. And at the bottom, it was just the score and it was just racking up. It was literally, you know, as you're going through, it's 8-4, 11-5, 13-5, 14-5, 15-5. You know, I think towards the end, when Captain Avalon is in the battle to kill a kitten and he can't do it, he tries, like, War's like, I'm just gonna, whatever, it's a kitten, and he goes to stop her, so he loses, and then it's 17-5. So just in a couple of pages, this crazy tournament goes from kind of close, where Krakoa seems like they still have a shot, to full blowout.
And this issue ends with another duel, this one being First to Blood, and it gets that callback to the dinner scene as it's Death v. Storm. And an interesting, another twist, Storm's mutant powers have been completely stripped for this duel.
Yeah, because she drank that liquor.
Yeah.
When we were just talking about the effects that that liquor had on Wolverine before his fight with War, Storm is still hammered off her ass when she comes for this fight. And so, yeah, she doesn't have the thunder. She doesn't have the rain. She is much more of a mortal in a sense, but she's got Skybreaker.
Yeah, and that's actually a key point. Once the fight gets going, Death kind of calls her out, like, what are you going to do without your mutant powers? And she immediately claps back and being like, my powers do not make me. Make me. And just gives it right back at him, which is pretty awesome. They end up having a fairly epic duel, and it looks really cool because it's all taking place in the realm of Sivaleth, which is just kind of this eclipsed reality where the moon and sun are together. It's this black hole in the sky. Everything's red.
Yeah.
Very fitting for Storm to be fighting Death here.
Yeah, it's like the world of vampires from what they gave us in the info pages, essentially. So you think about all of that really creepy, kind of techno, like, you know, the buildings and everything had that futuristic, you know, kind of sexiness that goes with vampires and stuff like that. But it was a really, really intense arena for one of the biggest fights of the entire matchup. And, you know, Storm just does not back down.
No, not at all. So Death kind of has to use his final move. He takes off his helmet. So far, he's been wearing like a pharaoh-like helmet that makes him look like a dog. He takes it off. You see that you only ever see the back of his head with the scarab kind of attached in the back of his head. He releases some sort of vapor, the look of death, at Storm. She closes her eyes, uses Skybreaker to deflect it back at him. He then gets stunned, and she just stabs him right through the gut, immediately makes him bleed. And in a true badass moment, she turns around and says, well, he's bleeding. And all of those vampires from the realm rush him and tear him apart.
Yeah, it was super cool. Yeah, I think his power is just straight up, you know, kind of the age old adage of if you gaze upon death, you know, you're essentially dying yourself. And so that's what it seems like they highlight there is he wears the helmet because nobody can look at him in the face without just pretty much disintegrating into death. So that was a really smart play that she had by reflecting it back. And it was just a great, great set of events there. And I thought that, the Savali people coming down almost like a pack of piranhas to just rip him apart was a really brutal way to take out a character like Death.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's a bit of a trope because we see that a lot. Somebody that holds power over lesser beings, when they finally get shrunk down to size, you know, those lesser beings tear them apart, but still very powerful and looked super cool because, one of the four horsemen is dead. It's one thing for Summoner to die against Wolverine, but we don't know much about Summoner. We didn't see the full extent to his power, But we know Death is one of the original Four Horsemen.
Yeah.
You know he's powerful. You know he's got this backup. And to see him go down, it's like, okay, yes, it would be a long shot, but maybe Krakoa can do this.
Right. And I think it brought the score to Arako 17, Krakoa 6.
Yes.
So don't call it a comeback just yet.
Don't call it a comeback just yet. So we'll jump into the next issue, which is part 18. It's Hellions number 6. Zeb Wells, Carmen Canero on writing and art duty on this one. We take a brief break from the tournament, and we pick up with the Hellions, who are once again on a mission to go steal the swords of Arako to prevent the tournament from happening. But that is too late. The tournament has already started. So as they sneak into the kingdom of Dryador through the gate into Arako, they realize that it's all for naught, because they're met by a being named Tarn the Uncaring. And he knows what they're up to. He knows that they're trying to sneak in to steal the swords, but lets them know that they're too late. And he actually ends up unleashing his own set of mutant creations on them.
Yeah, this was kind of wild. And Tarn was an interesting character, to be honest. They called him the genomic mage, or like genome mage.
Yeah.
Essentially, like his power is that he can manipulate the DNA and like genomes of mutants and pretty much shape them however he wants. So he really seems like he could be a character that maybe comes back around in the future. But up until I got back to Hellions here, there was a point reading some of the other issues where I was like, where is Sinister in the team?
Yeah.
You know, because that was the whole point, was for them to stop the tournament before it started. And then we've read, you know, 3 or 4 issues where the tournament had started, and it was just like, what was the point then of that whole issue? So we talked about how it was one of the least memorable issues of the first half of the event, and then it seemingly just didn't matter at all at this point until we finally come back around.
When you realize that Sinister has been playing his own game,
right.
He's been taking them round and about. When they enter the gate, you can see that they've been battered and torn. Havoc has lost an eye.
Yeah.
So he's been sneaking them around, and they actually accuse him of not knowing where he's going.
Right.
But then you find out, yeah, it's because he's playing a game, because what he's looking for is the mutant DNA of the Iraqi mutants, because that's what he wants to take back for his own gene pool.
Yeah, it's very selfish desires. He had no intention of doing anything to stop the contest. He entirely just wanted to come out and get more DNA for his clones, you know, all of the different experiments that he's doing. And I thought it was kind of funny because he shows his genetic collection drones.
Yeah.
You know, the GCDs, he calls them, and they're GCDs. Just little robotic mosquitoes. And I thought that was another good, funny, you know, Sinister moment. Like, of course, like a mosquito would be perfect for this, you know. Jurassic Park taught us that. But but it does not really go very well, because Tarn, kind of like Sinister, is very selfish. And he loves his creations probably just as much or more than Sinister loves his clones. So it really opened up to kind of an epic issue here.
Yeah, they had a pretty sweet battle, because Sinister was like, you have mutants? I'd love to see them.
Yeah.
And Tarn unleashes his group known as the Locust Vile on them, and they straight up kick the crap out of the Hellions.
They kind of looked like if Mad Max villains had mutants, you know? Like, they were all very grotesque and very weird and kind of that deserty, you know, steampunk kind of look to him. I don't even know how to fully describe it, but it just made me think about some of like the enemies in a Mad Max, with just like pieces of armor or masks, you know, that kind of vibe. But yeah, they had really, really weird powers though.
Yeah, like none of them were straightforward. They all look like amalgams. Like it clearly, I guess, obviously if Tarn is manipulating their DNA, it's what has come out of that. If he's constantly making changes and mutations, then they're going to take these weird shapes and forms and have growths and maybe a third arm or a random appendage sticking somewhere where it's not supposed to. And then, of course, they were all wearing blank masks, so you couldn't actually see their faces. And he makes a comment. He says, I can't believe you let your mutants look you in the eye.
Yeah, because they're like slaves to him, or
yeah,
lesser beings to him.
So Sinister releases his insects into the air to collect the data. While this insane battle is going on, Nanny gets instantly killed, the giant egg riding on the horse there. Empath says, I'm out of here. He bolts, releases Gray Cow from, you know, the servitude that he had him in the last issue. Havoc gets his hands cut off. They realize that it's just not going well. They eventually realize they have to retreat, get back to Krakoa. So Psylocke releases Wildchild onto them to kind of cover their escape. Wildchild goes into a pretty epic battle, but ultimately fails. And then we see Psylocke, Havoc, Gray Cow, and Empath. They all make their way back to Krakoa. They get there safely, only to, on arrival, be killed by Sinister's other clone.
It was a hell of a twist. And before we got quite there, there was a cool moment for the Sinister that was in Otherworld that was leading the team, where, you know, everything's lost. The Hellions team has gotten wrecked by the Locust Vial. And right at the end, after Psylocke and them start to escape, Tarn, like, snags Sinister with, like, it looked like kind of like a Jean Grey moment with, like, the telekinetic, that he's holding him up in the air.
Yeah.
And then he cuts him apart with his mind, essentially, into, you know, what looks like the, if you think about, like, butchery, and you see those posters of, like, the different primal cuts of an animal.
Yeah.
You know, here's the shoulder, here's the shin, here's, you know, it was like that. Like, he was segmented and just completely destroyed. And I thought that was a really cool moment that kind of showed the full power of Tarn beyond whatever he can do with the genome stuff. But yeah, then we get back over here to the Krakoa side, and it's treachery all on display.
Yep, he just murders them right as they come through the gate, takes the DNA collection that he has, because Sinister's always out for number one. So we'll see how that plays out moving forward. It's a really cool twist, and I really liked it in the scope of Hellions. But overall, I'm not sure if it's going to do anything to get me reading Hellions moving forward.
Yeah, probably not for Hellions itself, but I do think that it could have some interesting larger picture impacts.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you think about the Quiet Council and Xavier and Magneto and the others, you know, they've tolerated Sinister. They think that it's, you know, a necessary evil to have him on Krakoa, to have him at the seat of the table on the council, but nobody trusts him. Nobody really likes him. And now we see, at least from my view, having not read Hellions, you know, we see his most treacherous act against the nation of Krakoa and its people. And he covered his tracks, you know, he uses some gray smoke. He thinks that he's probably gotten away with it. Nobody's going to be able to see what he did, but we will have to see if that really ends up being the case. So I think that it might have some larger impacts for how the future of Krakoa goes and that type of stuff. But we're going to have to see, you know, in the rest of the issues here.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out, but we'll move on here back to the tournament, part 19, Cable number 6, and this is a doozy, folks. This one is a big time. I think up until this individual issue, that Wolverine number 7 was my favorite.
Yeah, I could agree.
And then it got eclipsed by this particular issue, because we start out with a Quiet Council meeting where Sinister, you know, is back at the table, and he's basically saying, like, look, the champions on the other side are done.
Yeah.
They're screwed. We can't do anything for them. We need to close this gate and prepare ourselves. And as a group, they refuse.
They don't know what to do with him. I mean, they don't know what to do at all.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know, it's definitely ominous news that they're getting back. He clearly hasn't succeeded on the mission that they sent him for. And they're still kind of just sitting on Krakoa waiting for real information on what exactly is going on, how things are playing out.
Right. So then we jump into the first of two battles that happen in this particular issue. The first one being Cable, and he has drawn Bay the Blood Moon, fresh off her marriage to Cypher. And this fight is really quick.
Yeah.
Because Bay comes in fast and hard. And mind you, it is a fight to the death. We're back to duels to the death. Bay comes in real hard, but Cable is prepared, and he actually gets the better of her and knocks her on the ground. He's about to go for the kill, but then he hesitates because he's mentally planning what he's going to do after he kills her to shield Cypher from the sight of his dead wife, and this brief hesitation backfires as Bay quickly reverses the position. She gets Cable pinned, breaks his arm, and then goes for the kill herself, and it looks like it's over for him.
Oh, yeah.
He's mentally apologizing to his dad, apologizing to his mom. He realizes that it's all over, he's going to die, and then right in the last moment, Cypher jumps in, and he stops Bay, begs her not to do it. She agrees, and in an interesting pro-Krakoan move, Saturnine agrees and declares that the fight is over and that a death of the spirit is good enough. She gives the point to Arakoa.
Yeah, she can see that Cable is like no longer a threat at this point. Like, he is completely broken mentally for the fact that he had the fight won and then lost, and he knows that everything is on the line. I thought it also kind of played well into him because young Cable clearly thinks that he is like lesser than old Cable.
Right.
You know, he references at times the other guy or the older version of himself, maybe because he's a kid versus like a grown man. So maybe different strength levels and that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was kind of an interesting moment for him. But once again, it was just okay, Cable's about to win. Maybe this is going to be the turn, the comeback. And then boom, he loses.
He loses. And I wanted to see what you thought about Bay, because it kind of seemed like she was a badass in her own right.
Oh, yeah. Bay is an interesting character from the moment. I mean, she's got a good look, but between what we see here and what we've seen throughout some of the other issues, you know, she is a very powerful warrior. She has definitely got some fight to her. And that mystery of not being able to understand her, the Death Note voice that she's got, you know, there's a lot going on there that I think we need to unpack over time.
Yeah. So Cable is broken, both mentally, physically here. He walks away and he starts to mentally reach out to his mother and father to apologize to them. And he actually does come into contact with Jean and Scott, who are back on Krakoa. And he informs them basically of what's going down. Like, the tournament's not going well. They're losing big time. And it looks like it's all going to be over and that they should prepare. But before he could get into any details, Saturnine just cuts off the mental link.
Yeah, another show of power that she can just literally, like, turn off the mental links between telepaths at a whim, because she pretty much just snaps her fingers and is like, that's enough of that.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite moments about this specific part was like a panel you see as Jean and Cyclops are getting some of the information, and Cyclops like immediately gets that dad rage.
Oh yeah.
He's just like goes into like protector mode, and he's just pissed at, like, you know, this is happening and he's not there. So it's the beginning of some interesting Cyclops moments that I thought were pretty cool.
And we will definitely touch on those. As a huge Cyclops fan, I definitely have some notes for Cyclops' decisions and how he portrays himself a little later on. But in this particular Cable number 6, we snap back to Otherworld, where the second duel to the death is about to begin. This one has been named The White Sword versus Gorgon. And heading into this one, it's 18-6 Arakko. And that becomes key, because once again, we get hit with an awesome, awesome twist. And I also have to say here, back in part one, I made a vow. I said I was a little worried about Gorgon falling into a really bad old trope where he walks in full of arrogance and he's all about himself and he's just going to get wiped out in seconds. Well, folks, it couldn't have been any more different. I couldn't have been any more wrong. Because essentially what happens is that the White Sword declares before Gorgon gets to fight him, he has to go through all of his 100 resurrected soldiers. And Gorgon agrees. He says, fine, who cares? Like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And the White Sword calls him out one by one in the beginning. So first, he calls out number one, and Gorgon just immediately decapitates him.
Yep.
Out the gate. No issues. Then it's two and three together. Gorgon slides under, slits their ankles, stabs him in the back, kills him. White Sword, clearly realizing that Gorgon is a force to be reckoned with, calls out 4, 5, 6 all at once. Gorgon isn't fazed at all, slices him up, no issues. And then the White Sword starts really sending him at him. Gorgon eventually uses his mutant powers, which is basically Gorgon of Greek mythology, where he can turn people instantly into stone.
Yeah.
One of the soldiers gouges his eyes out, so then he's been blinded, but he's still fighting like a madman, cutting soldier after soldier down, and it's just this epic moment for Gorgon. You're like, hell yeah. Everything I was worried about is out the window. This dude is taking it to these other forces.
Yeah, we were worried about him being kind of a sacrificial lamb because of how little they've really given us about him and talked about him. But it couldn't have gone down in any better of a way. You know, just the epitome of honor in doing what he's doing. Gorgon just stood until he couldn't stand anymore. And I really thought that it was awesome, you know, after he gets blinded and he gets his, I mean, it was just straight eye gouging too.
Yeah.
And he gets his eyes ripped out. The White Sword calls in the remaining champions. I think at that point, Gorgon had killed 13 of them or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And he calls in the remaining champions, and there was a cell where Gorgon stands back up with the two swords, and he just says, come and die. And he's just like, fuck it. You know, he's like, we're going to take it on. I don't care what you send at me. We're going to do this. And ultimately, it might have gone a little bit of a different way, but his sacrifice couldn't have meant any more.
Oh, no. As soon as he's done slaying all of these warriors, Saturnine kind of announces that each warrior has counted for 1 point and that the overall score is now 19-18 Krakoa.
Yeah, he takes the lead.
Yet another Opal Saturnine game is being played, and totally pissed off with the White Sword, War demands that he ends this and steps into the fight himself.
Yeah.
Finish the duel. And I'll say the next series of panels is my favorite in the whole event.
Hard to argue.
Like, because the White Sword agrees to enter the fight and he agrees with it. I was just waiting for you to grovel. Back to War. So he agrees to step in. He starts to monologue on Gorgon a little bit. And it was pretty amazing because he goes, the White Sword stands before you, Gorgon, your life slipping away. In a moment, it will all be over. When it is done, I will restore you and you will serve me. And Gorgon stands up proudly and says, never. I walk my own path.
Goosebumps.
And it's just this hell yeah.
Yeah.
And the White Sword, I could impose my will. Gorgon answers back, not over me. And right in that moment, the White Sword stabs him through the heart, kills him, and an Apocalypse turns to Magic, Cypher, and Cable and says, that is how a mutant dies, children.
Yeah, it was so good. I literally had all of that written down because I was like, I totally agree with you that one of the most epic moments in so many different ways as this played out. And I thought that it was super cool to see the respect between the White Sword and Gorgon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas maybe in other circumstances, you know, the White Sword would probably look at Gorgon as like beneath him. And he ultimately, you know, does him the honor of not forcing him to become one of his champions.
Right.
And so, you know, just every little aspect of this fight was masterfully crafted, masterful storytelling, and really puts Gorgon kind of on a pedestal. You know, he still got sacrificed, so we weren't entirely wrong there, but instead of being kind of a throwaway, it became probably the most important death that we've seen up to this point.
Oh, yeah. And by far the most powerful scene in the whole event, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so when the White Sword kills Gorgon, he did win the fight, essentially, but because every kill from this fight counted as a point, the other interesting thing here was that it ultimately ended up tied 19-19.
It does. And then that brings us to the end. Saturnine claims that there are only two cards left to play, but she doesn't get to actually announce it because, like we said earlier at the dinner, Genesis / Annihilation and Apocalypse, they understand that all of this is preordained. All of it is fate.
Yep.
And I love this moment because Annihilation turns and says, there's no need for your theatrics, witch. And then Apocalypse finishes the sentence, says, we know what comes next. And so you know that the final duel in this whole situation is going to be Annihilation or Genesis versus Apocalypse.
Yeah, I thought it was really great how they ended this out. You know, you get the full info page on the entire battle log. So it shows us that we've had 25 contests that have led to the score. and list them all out and who won. We're not going to go through all of that, but it was a nice kind of recap on everything that we had seen. And then you get a full page illustration of Annihilation and Apocalypse both crossing swords, you know, essentially starting the fight, and then boom, we're on to the next issue.
Yeah, and that next issue being X-Men number 15, part 20, the penultimate issue of Ten of Swords. This issue goes back and forth between two settings, and it's essentially Jean and Scott standing before the council, telling them about how they were in contact with Cable, they found out that it's not going well, and that they want to lead a rescue mission, intertwined with moments from the duel itself.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a great back and forth, you know, between them kind of saying there's this desperation happening on the other side, because in their last contact, Krakoa was down a lot and it was hopeless. They were not going to win and they needed to make this effort to go rescue their people. The council's not on board with this.
Yeah.
You know, they chose to go. They chose to do this. They're fighting for us. And we need to think about our nation as a whole. We cannot send you in good faith. And Jean and Cyclops are like, okay, well, that's not good enough. We're still going.
This freaking issue just oozed drama.
Yeah.
I mean, just the back and forth here was, it just had you on the edge of your seat. And in two totally different ways.
Yeah.
You know, because the one is this epic sword fight, and the other is essentially like a board meeting. But seeing and hearing the things that Cyclops is saying to them about what needs to be done and what he wants to do, you know, regardless of what comes out of the Quiet Council's decision making, you know, it just, more goosebumps. It just fills you up. It's the reasons why you gotta like Cyclops, even if you don't like Cyclops.
Oh, he's a natural leader.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times that's why you don't like him, because he comes across arrogant. He's always trying to be, you know, the big blue boy scout. Or it's funny, you see all these things that you like about Superman or you like about Captain America. Cyclops has them too.
Yeah, that's true.
But typically you hate them in Cyclops for whatever reason, or most of the people do. I really like Cyclops. He's always been one of my favorites. I like his mutation, but I also just like him as a character. He's just a natural born leader. He's had a lot of weight put on his shoulders from a young age to lead mutants into the future.
Yeah, and well, the thing with the Boy Scouty type moments, Captain has them, like you said, Superman, you know, anybody that is in that realm has them, you know, when they're overused or it's something that you kind of get like a moment in every issue or every time they show up, you know, it comes off as hokey or corny and things like that. And I think that kind of naturally creates some disdain for any character. But the beauty of those types of characters in this type of writing, though, is that when you need a moment like this and you have that good Boy Scout, like those, that flip side is, it's so inspiring and it's so good. And like everybody wants to be that person.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what you say. So it's like you gotta kind of have to take the good with the bad with characters like these. And this was just kind of that flip side moment where he wasn't coming in to just drop a corny line. He wasn't coming in to just do the right thing for the sake of doing the right thing. He's coming in to do the right thing to save his people.
And his family.
His
blood children, yeah. It's just really well done. I think of an Avengers Endgame where Captain makes that inspiring speech right before they travel through time.
Right.
And Ant-Man, he's really good at that. You know, they break the humor, but it is that moment. You need him to come in, make the speech. He crushes the speech. And this issue really highlights what has been well done throughout all of Dawn of X when it is done well, and that it's high action, combat, great art, great panels in the duel in itself, but it's also a lot of political drama. Like you said, the board meeting, and they've made those parts just as interesting as they have the action sequences.
Yeah, because essentially here what we see is, you know, Cyclops saying, hey, we need to rally everybody. We need to go and just take this to Otherworld. You know, damn the torpedoes. I think he says something like, I want to shake them to their foundation and pretty much just use his brute force, you know, military stylings to just win this fight. and Xavier and Sebastian Shaw and, you know, some of the other mutants on the council, you know, call them on certain things like, what if you fail, bro?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, there are consequences if you don't win. I know you're confident, I know you're brave, but you have to consider the fact that you may lose. And ultimately, the council needs to consider the fact that they may lose. And so we see some really big votes. You know, they vote essentially to not send other people with them. And then they vote to say, hey, if you go, you're no longer on the council.
Right.
And granted, Cyclops and Jean weren't, or maybe Jean was, but I know Cyclops isn't technically on the council. He's one of the war captains, but he's involved. But, you know, there was some consequences coming out of the things that they were deciding for Cyclops, even though they needed to say, hey, we need to chill. You know, Xavier, Magneto can't go because we need to maintain the continuity of the Krakoan government.
Right. And to that specifically, Shaw does vote that, okay, if y'all want to go do this, but you're giving up your seat.
Yeah.
And then Jean says, I don't care. Like this, Jean is totally done with the council and this Krakoan government. We saw that in the pages of X-Force leading into this. She's unhappy with the way mutants have transitioned into this, like this post Hoxpox life in Dawn of X.
Gotcha.
Where she's not happy with what's going on. She wasn't happy with Beast and the CIA and
gotcha.
The shadiness of all the X-Force. So she's done with that. And now she's done with the council. She says, I don't want to go. And interesting, a few other council members try to go, but ultimately get talked out of it. We see Kate Pryde tries to go.
Right.
She gets denied. Nightcrawler wants to go, but he gets denied. Emma and Cyclops have a bit of a psychic conversation. And Cyclops realize, like, no, I don't want you to go. Like, you are needed here. But two votes are passed, and those two votes being, one, if you choose to go, like, you're off the council. And two, after you go, we're going to close the gate.
Right, yes. That was the other thing, was the big impact of the gate, because that could essentially lock them over on the other world and all the consequences that come with that. I do have to say, too, I thought that this set up a really great moment for one of the most interesting info panels, you know, so we see everything going down here between Cyclops and Jean and the council. And essentially what Cyclops is saying is, hey, you know, we're X-Men.
Yeah.
And this is what we do. And we do what's right. I was taught to do what's right. This is right. We have to go do this. And he kind of brings back up the concept of the X-Men. And then we get this info panel that made me realize, I don't know if you had the same thoughts here, so I was curious, but it talks about how when they formed Krakoa, that they actually kind of deemed X-Men as a naughty word.
Yeah.
And as something that could be, you know, an offensive term. It's no longer PC. And, you know, it's this whole thing about how they try to exterminate the use of the term X-Men on the island of Krakoa. And I was like, damn you, Hickman, this is so freaking brilliant, because it wasn't until this moment, we've been reading these damn stories and talking about them for over a year now, and it wasn't until that freaking page that I realized that outside of the title of the X-Men itself book, we had not seen them use the words X-Men or the terms X-Men anywhere in Dawn of X.
I'm right there with you. I was shocked that over a year of reading, we didn't realize that they had actually formally disbanded the X-Men as a group.
Yeah.
And they weren't using it in the pages. I think the last time we actually read it, and I could be wrong, was when Xavier first rehatched his first batch. And he said, to me, my X-Men. And then anything after that, they stopped.
That's a good thought.
They stopped using that term altogether. And it really was. It was quite amazing. And these info pages were very powerful, because it talks about the Krakoan government and how the need to move forward as mutants.
Right.
And how they can't get away from the term X-Men. And they understand that because for so long, because of the history of the word and its association with mutants, that they can't totally get away with it. So they will deal with it. They won't use it internally.
Right.
But, and they're not going to punish anybody for using the word now outside of, you know, the Krakoan government. Like if other humans want to call them X-Men, it almost broke the fourth wall a little bit for me, because it was like, okay, hey reader, hey people that talk about, you know, the X-Men series and Krakoan government and mutants in general, we know that you're going to use the word X-Men when you reference our comics.
Sure.
But understand that X-Men is a old term that we'd like to get away from, that it's mutant kind that we'd like you to say from this point forward. And these were fantastic, as always, with all the info pages and the data pages that they write and intertwine into these books. This one just took it up another notch, not only for the callback, but also moving forward and what this means for the Krakoan government.
Yeah, it really started to get my mind going as far as that aspect, right? Like, okay, what does this mean moving forward? We're seeing Cyclops essentially say, I'm an X-Men, screw it, I'm going to do these things. Now we're being told, you know, these aspects of how they view that. So what will that mean moving forward, you know, when the dust settles here? Are we going to get the rebirth of the X-Men on Krakoa or not? And so it really had my mind going. But, you know, in the midst of all of this, we've really got to go back to the showdown in Otherworld.
Right.
We're overlooking, you know, one of the most epic parts of the tournament that's going on while this is happening on Krakoa.
You're 100% right. Like, while all this drama is taking place on the council in Krakoa, Genesis and Apocalypse are having a duel to the death. And it was very interesting at the beginning of this duel, Apocalypse basically says, is this how you're going to fight me? You're going to fight me as Annihilation, because Genesis is wearing the helm and walking into the battle. And Apocalypse says, like, is this how you're going to do it? This how you're going to fight me? Like, hidden behind this helm. And despite what Annihilation wants, what the helm wants, Genesis says, no, I will fight you as myself. And she takes off the helm, and Annihilation is screaming at her. That other voice in her head is saying, no, what are you doing? Don't do this. Put me back on. This is my fight. And she says, no, like, I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to win. You're weak, my love. And they have a epic back and forth, both landing blows. I think at one point she takes the Twilight Sword and breaks Scarab in half.
Yeah, completely shatters his sword.
Completely shatters this ancient weapon of Apocalypse, only for him to kind of now have almost a little dagger, which allows him to get closer to her. He makes a swift move, cuts her through the gut, gets her down, about to make the final blow, but won't do it. He says, I have waited millennia to have you back in my life, to have my wife back with me, to see you again. I'm not going to wait all that time to finally get you back and have it end like this. Saturnine's pissed.
Yeah.
She doesn't want that. She's like, nope, that's not how this works. You will kill her.
Yeah, it was another huge moment of drama here. And I do have to call out real quick is that right before Apocalypse turns the tables on Genesis and cuts her, like you mentioned, I thought that there was an interesting moment that kind of harkened back to some of the issues we saw pre-event. And so, you know, when she breaks the sword and she cuts him in the arm, I think, you know, she's got the upper hand. She thinks that she's got him beat. And she's, you know, essentially kind of gloating a little bit. She's dialoguing and she's, you know, essentially asking him to yield. You're done. Why don't you just yield? This can be over. She doesn't want to kill him any more than he wants to kill her.
Right.
So that's where she's kind of thinking that this is going to end. And he refuses to yield. You know, he goes into one of his monologues talking about how he's waited this long. He's not going to yield to love or hate or weakness or anything. And it really reminded me of the one issue of X-Men. I think it was X-Men, but where they do the Crucible.
Yeah.
And they show us, you know, how they're rebirthing the mutants that lost their powers, you know, through the hatchery system into the mutants that they, with their powers again, and this Crucible format where they had to fight Apocalypse, die, and show that they wanted it that much. And throughout that Crucible, he's asking her, you know, will you yield? Will you give up? You're beaten. And it's all around that concept of yielding and, like, how much do you want this?
Right.
How much do you love mutantdom and mutant kind? And they don't really give you a direct line back to that. And I don't know if you had any of these same vibes, but, like, that moment there just looked to me like a tables turned version of the Crucible. And I thought it was a cool callback, or at least that's how I read it.
I didn't quite put that together, but now that you're saying it, it's very much so. Like, in the Crucible, Apocalypse makes you earn being a mutant, because at the time, he was fighting... Oh, I forgot who he was fighting in the Crucible, but they had been turned into a human. It was a layover from House of M when Scarlet Witch took all the mutants' powers away and reduced them down to the 180, however many were left on the planet. And so they had to fight to become mutant again and go through the Crucible. So you're right. Like, I didn't think about that when I first read it, but now that you're saying it, it is exactly like that. Like, there is no yielding. If you truly want to be here, you need to earn to be here.
Yeah, and this was Apocalypse's Crucible, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, and I just thought that was super cool, but we can jump back into it. Like you said, you know, Genesis is defeated.
Doesn't want to kill her. Saturnine's not cool with it. And in that moment, a dying, bleeding out Genesis reaches out, and the Annihilation Helm becomes too much, and she dons the helmet. And that's how this particular issue ends. And I apologize, because I said this was the penultimate issue. It's actually not the penultimate issue. The next one is Excalibur 15, part 21. And then we go into X of Swords Destruction, which is part 22. And it's kind of at this point, the rest of Ten of Swords turns into just straight chaos.
Chaos. It's the only way to put it.
It's really the only way to put it. So I'll go ahead and say, from this point forward, we're going to be talking about Excalibur number 15, part 21, and X of Swords Destruction, part 22, kind of all together, because it just blends. It would be too much to take you piece by piece, because all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
Genesis dons the helmet, and literally all hell breaks loose on the Starlight Citadel. The Dark Army of Amenth starts attacking. Storm strikes Annihilation with a bolt of lightning, and then they're like, hey, we got to get out of here. The rules of this tournament no longer apply. It's every mutant for themselves, or like Krakoan mutants for themselves. We need to get out of here. We need to retreat and find a way to battle back.
Yeah, Annihilation is pretty much over dealing with this tournament. She's kind of been entertaining everything and letting things go. And once Genesis puts the helm back on, it heals her, like you said. And then she pretty much, Annihilation just calls in the entire power of Amenth. Everything. The army, the monsters, everything. And just says, we're done here. We're going to invade regardless. And you see this impossible odds, you know, immediately stack up now, because it's millions and millions of vile creatures and powerful beings against essentially the 9 remaining champions of Araco, or 8.
8.
You know, since Gorgon's gone.
Yeah. Well, it would be 7.
Well, 7.
Because as we pointed out in part 1, the Krakoan mutants only ever added up to 9. They were supposed
to have
10 champions, 10 swords, and they never actually got to 10. They had 9. So with Betsy Braddock being dead and Gorgon also being dead, it brings them down to 7. So like,
and Cable's actually out from injury. So
and Cable's out from
6
injuries.
Of them.
Yeah, they're down to a half dozen. It is. And thousands, like you said, thousands, and there's waves coming. They got to figure out what to do. There's so much chaos happening. They try to drag Apocalypse away from the battle. He doesn't want to go. And they're like, hey, man, you need to get your head on straight. Like, it's rain and fire out here.
Yeah.
And we need to come up with an attack plan. And I think at one point they group up and somebody's like, we just need to hold the line. And they're like, look, we saw how that worked out for Gorgon.
Yeah.
And it's not going to work out for us here. Like, we are too vastly outnumbered. What's going on? All in this chaos, we see the champions of Araco also be like, look, this isn't what we signed up for.
Some of
them,
yeah.
This is too much. Like, we came here to duel, to compete in this contest. Like, Pogger Pog is upset. He doesn't know what's going on. The White Sword is totally disgusted.
He leaves,
with all of the actions. He turns. He literally does. He turns and gathers his army and just says, roll out. And I think they call him a coward at some point. Like, what are you doing? Like, how can you just walk away from this? And he's like, I came for one thing, and it wasn't this.
Yeah.
There's no honor in this, and I'm done. So he leaves with his forces, which you think would balance it back out, but it doesn't matter. There's thousands of the Dark Army.
Yeah, it gets bleak. I mean, I think at one point, you know, you've got Storm trying to to give them some cover, you know, using her powers to create, you know, lightning and rain and everything, so that way they can kind of retreat a little bit. And the onslaught is just pushing. And even Saturnine,
yeah,
you know, we see in the Excalibur issue that Saturnine is essentially retreated back to the Citadel. She is doing something on her own, gathering her priestesses, and essentially, I think this is the beginning of where we see her march into one of her rooms, and she pulls out the shards of Betsy Braddock.
Yeah.
And kind of sits down calmly, though, but like almost in that state of like calm madness. But she's like putting together a puzzle, like drinking a glass of wine, and she's forming the pieces back together pretty much while the world is just burning right outside. In this issue, you don't exactly know what's about to happen. Even though we already went through all these twists and turns, it's all just been broken wide open, and it's really, really looking bad for not just the Krakoans, but the Citadel itself.
Oh, yeah, and every page, every panel is just blood and gore, and there's arrows flying about, people getting chopped in half. Just, you don't know who's going to come in, what's going to happen. You see Bay run in, kind of change sides. She scoops up Cypher, tries to run away with him. He convinces her to not and to fight for the side of Krakoa, you know, because you kind of find out that she's in love with him, too.
Right.
So, like, you know, that marriage that was all part of the contest has turned into true love. So there's this nice little love story in the middle of all the chaos, which is kind of wild. Just visually, so much going on. And then Jubilee reappears.
Yeah.
Like, boom, with the priestesses of the Citadel. They come in for backup. So you get a little bit of backup to hopefully even the odds. But once again, the forces of Amoneth are just too much. There's too many.
Yeah, it definitely didn't even the odds so much as it just, like, gave them some more time.
Yeah.
You know, it bought the Champions of Krakoa some more time. It bought Saturnine more time with whatever she's doing in the Citadel. And they're able to just kind of survive for a few more minutes as things continue to unfold. And through all of this, it's kind of cool because the end of the Excalibur issue, we get a nice cliffhanger because, you know, it goes back to Saturnine. The world is going on, like we said, outside. And she finishes the putting the glass back together, and it's another image of Betsy Braddock as Captain Britain. And between that and some of the magic that she was casting while she did this, we actually see the full return of the Captain Britain Corps, which was a huge thing, especially if you've been following Excalibur all this time and all the talk that they've had about Captain Britain and the Corps. And we see, you know, the Captain Britons from all the other worlds around the realities are commanded to protect the Citadel and protect the world. So they all come in. And it also kind of gives us that glimpse into what Saturnine's motivation was this whole time, because she really just wanted the Captain Britain Corps to become back. So you almost kind of get this feeling that she helped create this conflict, so that way she can force all of them back together. And it also comes with a little bit of heartbreak because she still doesn't get Brian Braddock. You know, ultimately the magic and everything, fate, if you will, has it that Betsy Braddock is Captain Britain. And I think it even says in one of the panels, now and forever.
Yeah, it does. And so they pop up. She's not happy that she resurrected Betsy.
Mm-mm.
Or resurrected, she wants the Captain Britain Corps back, but she doesn't want Betsy back. Exactly.
Right.
So she's a little shocked right there at the end of that paddle. She puts all of the stained glass pieces back together, and it is that image of Betsy, and she's like, no, this isn't what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted Brian. But the Captain Britain Corps comes back, and they enter the fight, and they start wrecking house. Like, that's really what evens the odds a little bit.
Exactly. That is where it started to kind of shift the tolls and help out Krakoa a lot more, because Captain Britons are super powerful, and we can't get into all of them, but there's also some funny ones, because like one's a duck.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a billion different versions of Braddock family members and stuff, but they're all very powerful in their own right. So when they come in, it was also interesting because we see Annihilation tell War to have the summoners call in the rest.
Right.
You know, call in all the monsters, call in the worst of the worst. and it just escalates. You know, as each side kind of gets their little advantages, things just continue to escalate somehow beyond where they already are.
Oh, yeah. And then we double down on the straight chaos in the streets, as I wrote it down, like, because that's all it is. It's just chaos in the streets. There's mutants, Captain Britain Corps. And then right at the beginning of the issue, Destruction, X of Swords Destruction, which is the final issue, we see Cyclops contact Magic and say, hey, we need you to open a portal. We're on the way to help you.
Yes.
She opens up the portal and she brings in what we now know is the 10th sword for the Krakoan side. And it is the Sword Station, which, as a callback, has that alien horde, the Borg-like aliens that we were talking about in part one. They all show up, and I'm gonna give myself a little bit of kudos, because I was like, ooh, maybe they're gonna use this horde against the forces of Maneth, and then that's ultimately what they did. But it just doubles down on the insanity of this final issue. Like, I tried to kind of mark what all was happening, and it became so difficult, because it really was mutants, Captain Britain Corps, the monsters that the summoners were bringing in, the sword alien horde, everyone just fighting, beasts, swords, arrows, blood, body parts, everything. And then at the center of all this, Apocalypse is still fighting Annihilation,
yeah,
like, to the death. It's just absolutely chaotic. Like, every single issue, or every single panel, every single page was just chaos.
Oh, yeah. It made up for any slowness in the beginning of the event. It'll be probably the number one thing to almost, not the only thing that I'll remember, but it gives you a really solid way to remember this event and, like, something epic that happened. You know, there was a bunch of really good moments here and there through the previous, 21 issues. But when you get to this point, it is just full tilt, and I thought it was a great, awesome bit of reading, even if you didn't have the rest.
Yeah.
You needed it to make up and understand what was going on, but just looking at this book and the action and the chaos that's going on, it was just an entertaining, 40-something pages. But damn, when Magic opens up the portal, And Cyclops comes in with the Sword Station, and you realize that was the 10th sword, and that was another, they hid that little detail at the earlier part of the event, and bringing it back, it was just freaking ridiculous, bro. Like, I was just jumping out of my seat at how awesome that was, because you gotta think, if you haven't seen the Sword Station, just think, like, Imperial Star Destroyer.
Yeah.
Out of Star Wars. Like, the giant Imperial arrowhead-looking Star Destroyers is what this thing is pretty much built like. And it's just dropping out of the sky above the Starlight Citadel and brings not only Cyclops, but a whole army.
Oh, horde. Yeah.
Of the X-Men, but really all the other mutants of Krakoa.
Yeah.
They were the 10th mutant. It was all of Krakoa, not just one person. And I just thought it was amazing. Everybody but the Quiet Council came with Cyclops.
Yeah.
They were all X-Men.
They were all there. Yeah, they were all X-Men. They all wanted to be there to fight. And harking back to the Crucible, they needed to earn this life that they had. And it's one of those things that we kind of skipped over when we talked about the dinner. But there was a nice little moment between... I believe it was Iska and Bay, or somebody was talking about being like, you can't help but notice the differences in these Krakoan mutants. And they almost called them soft. And they said, and the response to that was, well, imagine that the life that they got to grow up in.
Yeah.
Like, they grew up in peace and prosperity. Like, I'm almost jealous in some way. And here we are. Like, yes, they got to grow up in peace and prosperity, but they're also fighting for what they have,
right,
and what they want moving forward. So very powerful images, very just the metaphors all around. Well done. Like you said, any slowness leading up to this is kind of made up for it to some extent with this massive, supersized issue in Destruction. And that didn't end it. That wasn't all of the destruction.
Nope.
Because eventually Saturnine finds her way into the fray, riding on Shogo. like a giant dragon into the mix, breathing fire, burning everyone up to a crisp.
Yeah, and we pretty much come here to the ending of it. So all this is going on. Factions keep getting added, essentially. Bodies keep getting thrown into the chaos, to the fight. And we finally return back to Annihilation and Apocalypse. And this, for me, being a big fan of villains, being a big fan of Apocalypse, and following Excalibur, was the payoff moment. You know, so we see them fighting it out, and we ultimately see Apocalypse pretty much kind of just through sheer will and not being willing to give up thing, you know, the fight, he pretty much rips the helm off of Genesis's face,
yeah,
as he beats her and takes it. And, you know, we see just these epic panels, these couple pages of him holding the helm, and you kind of get this glimpse into it. It's not just this golden piece of metal, but it's actually, it's like a spirit flame. It kind of looked like an evil flame boy,
yeah,
you know, from back in the day. And he's kind of looking into it, and they're squaring off, and he puts it on.
Yeah, he puts it on. Well, he can't totally resist.
Right.
And he
right.
puts it on. One of the awesome parts about him putting it on is that he overpowers it from within, which is something no one else in the history of the helm has ever been able to do. Like one, like we said, you put it on and it controls you. You're still two different beings, but you do everything the helm wants you to do.
Right.
But Apocalypse is too strong. His will is too strong to just allow this. And he actually marches right up to Saturnine, and you're not totally sure what's going to happen. And he overpowers Annihilation and yields to her.
Yeah.
Which is, and the helm is pissed. It's screaming in his head as he's got it on, but yet he still wields to Saturnine. And then in a very interesting little twist here, she takes it and she manipulates it.
Yes, and it was yet another example of how freaking powerful she is, because, you know, through all of this, it seems like nobody can control the helm. Genesis couldn't fully, Apocalypse can't 100%, though he has a good moment here. And she seemingly just kind of takes it from him and then starts turning it into something else.
Yeah.
And that's how much power she has, to that it doesn't impact her, it doesn't affect her like it does everybody else. And she's like, what? It's like a balloon animal. Like, it's,
yeah,
sort of like, just, you know, do you want a sword? Do you want a staff? Do you want a puppy dog? You know? And she's just like forming this thing, this insanely powerful evil being of the universe, like it's nothing. And you're just like, damn.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how strong is Opal Luna Saturnine?
It's true. It's true. She's over, like, this thing that is essentially overpowered Genesis, somewhat overpowered Apocalypse, you know, by sheer force of will, he did, but you never know what it would have done to him long term. And she just takes it, manipulates it, and turns it into a staff. She does establish that it does still hold some power, and those who hold it and wield it will have be influenced by it,
yeah,
but no longer totally controlled by it the way it was. But she does. She throws down. She flexes all of her magic muscles on it. And you kind of see the reason why she is the protector of the Starlight Citadel in Otherworld.
Yeah, she's the protector of literally all realities and the glue that holds them all together. So, you know, it makes sense that she is as powerful as she is. I think she gave the staff ultimately back to Genesis. And let her, at least that's the last we saw of it, was that it, you know, Genesis has it, but it's not in that same controlling manner as when it was the helm being worn. So I thought that was pretty wild. And I guess kind of the one of the last things here then was that we saw, to end the conflict, Saturnine pretty much demands that, you know, each side take a ward of the other,
yeah,
as a show of good faith. You know, as a way to essentially keep the peace, if it makes sense. And so we see Genesis get to pick one. And I thought it was kind of funny because Cyclops, thinking he just won the battle, which was really kind of funny. You know, he kind of comes in and he was super, super helpful in winning the battle. But he, at the end here, he's kind of like, yeah, well, I'm the general. I'm the head of the war here and we just won. So I'm going to pick who it's going to be. And Apocalypse is like, slow your roll, bro. This one's mine. I've been waiting forever to do this. And you want to share who they picked on both sides?
So ultimately, they choose for Apocalypse to stay on the Iraqi side of things. And then Apocalypse chooses Akroa, the mutant island of Akroa, to go back with Krakoa, which will now form the full island of Okara on Earth.
And brings all the mutants from both sides together, which creates some very interesting dynamics moving forward. I thought that that was a great moment and something that, you know, they've been prophesizing and talking about and hinting at. And we've even seen, you know, between the island of Krakoa and the island of Arrakis, since they are mutants themselves, we've seen their wills, you know, to be reunited, put back together, come through, you know, when there was conflicts about shutting gates and doing different things. And they, you know, Krakoa refused to do it, kind of forced the mutants into this situation. You know, that was their big payoff, even for some of those storylines that were getting told, you know, going back super far.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are so many interesting things that are going to come out of Ten of Swords. Mainly being, I wrote a few down, we've got Jean and Apocalypse off the Quiet Council. Because with Apocalypse staying on this other side, he's gone for a while.
Yeah.
And Jean choosing to go, she gave up her seat. So that leaves 7 on the Quiet Council. How are they going to be replaced? We also see the addition of Akroa back with Krakoa on Earth and bringing all of those mutants. And they said there's millions of mutant prisoners underneath the island. So all of those mutant prisoners are going to be coming back to Earth. That's wild. The island itself is now going to double in size. So any human governments left on Earth that were upset about the influence that Krakoa had already is now going to have to realize that the island is double in its mass,
right,
and possibly doubled in its population. Like, there's just so much to kind of pull from. Like, what is this going to look like moving forward? And then what are we going to get? Because we have seen the next era of mutantdom is now going to be known as the Reign of X.
Right.
So we started out with House of X, Powers of Ten. That led into the Dawn of X. We had about a year of Dawn of X. Ten of Swords closed that era and then gives birth to the next era, which is the Reign of X.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting title for the next era, simply because one of the things that we saw here at the very end of Destruction was, you know, a little couple moments with Saturnine and one of her helpers, and, you know, they're kind of just reflecting on all that happened, and the helpers, you know, asking her if she knew that all of this was going to happen, and she's kind of giving out the secrets of, you know, hey, I knew some things were going to happen, other things I didn't. And one of the very specific things that Saturnine says, you know, that she calls out was that the Quiet Council is broken and it had the first two cracks.
Hmm.
And she's like referencing essentially big shifts coming. And if you think about everything that happened here, Sinister, Apocalypse, the changes in members, you know, the whole nine yards, and then couple that with the fact that now Charles and Magneto and them are going to have to govern over a significantly larger population that is also essentially got all these foreigners that aren't familiar with what Krakoa has going on. You know, they're also probably a lot more volatile. You think, like, we don't even know where Solemn is.
Yeah.
And some of those types of characters that might be a little bit more hot-headed, harder to control. Like, it really is going to be an interesting shift. And so it's like, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? So I don't know if I buy into, like, Reign of X as positively as it just kind of comes off.
Yeah. And there's a lot to break down. They've put out a little preview pages, and you look at it, you can piece different things together. Obviously, dead center, we see Bay and Cypher together. So that storyline's going to continue. We've seen a few shifts. I think another couple hidden things in this is Arcade Mojo and the original Nimrod are all, you know, highlighted somewhere in this and that.
Okay.
So, and one of the core things, now that you've said this with all these extra mutants, one of the core values of Krakoa has been make more mutants.
True, yeah.
And now here they are, they don't have to make them anymore, obviously, but they have doubled this population. It could be very, very interesting with them broken. And I know that before we got into X of Swords, when last we talked about X-Men in Chapter 18, we thought we were fading on it. And it hadn't been as good as we had wanted it to be. You know, it was really good out the gate, and then it started to fade. And then we thought even in part one of Ten of Swords, it was really, really slow. So now the question is, after this back end of Ten of Swords, after the final half, and we see all these changes and shakeups, has this reinvigorated the X-Men and mutant kind to continue with our, you know, our breakdowns, our readings? And because as it stands, X-Men is a lot of reading.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of reading that goes into mutants if you want to track the full story. So where does it sit with you?
Man, I went back and forth so much as I went through this. You know, like you said, we came into it kind of on the downside, but we saw those, you know, issues 11, issues 12 out of a lot of the books started to kind of pop back to life and really get the intrigue going, get the excitement going, you know, as it came into this. And then, you know, we went back down a little bit at the beginning of the event where we weren't thinking it was as exciting as we were expecting. And, you know, it was twice the size of House and Powers. So, like, you know, I guess to some extent that was probably to be expected. Those, every one of the 12 issues was just packed full of stuff. Here we had 22, so probably had to slow play it a little bit more. I will say two things. It made me want an Avengers versus X-Men versus style follow-up.
Yeah.
Because we never truly got the fights that we were almost promised. And even though it all worked out and there was a payoff, like, I still have this itch to just see Solemn versus Wolverine or whatever it may be. So, like, Hickman, if you're out there, if you're listening, just go make that book.
Yeah.
Like, we'll buy them. Give us all 10 sword fights that you promised us and let us have that fun. But I kept going back and forth. It kept going back and forth all the way up to the end with this question. And I thought for sure at times that I was going to be done with X-Men after this. And then I thought for sure at times that I was fully back on board.
Yeah.
So this was really, really tough. I think where I landed and where I'm going to do my approach moving forward is that I think that it earned enough respect and interest in the whole nine yards to make me want to at least read the next six.
Okay.
I think I want to see what happens coming out of it. I think it did just enough that I think that, you know, if the next six issues of the books we've been following can follow up and really build on it, then okay, you've got me for another year or two on these books. If it doesn't, if it comes right back out slow or whatever, then I may, you know, cut the cord for the time being and put my attention on some other books. So that's where I'm at right now. I will continue following for the moment, but it's got a short leash.
Yeah, it's really got to hit the ground running in December and January with this next couple issues, really give you a hook and kind of shake up the dynamic.
Show me what's coming. Show me what to expect. Give me a reason to stick around even more.
Do you think you will continue to read Excalibur? Because obviously we're going to continue to read the X-Men main series, but what about the ones on the fringes like Excalibur, X-Force, Marauders, etc.?
That's probably a little bit of the bigger question. Like, I've really liked Excalibur, and since we found out that this event had so much to do with the Excalibur storyline, I'm twofold, because it's like, okay, now I do want to see the next steps. I want to see if Luna Saturnine sticks around as a character. You know, Apocalypse is gone. How does that change the dynamics of what's going on in the Excalibur team? But on the flip side, I feel like since this all kind of got used up here, maybe they move away from Excalibur and the emphasis becomes way more on X-Factor or Hellions or one of the other books. And that becomes the more important kind of flagship issue, you know,
right,
moving into a future event or whatever down the line. So that I'm struggling with a little bit more, you know, as far as exactly which books I would want to follow. But I think for the moment, I'll stick with what I have been reading, at least for the first couple issues, see where they go, and then maybe make some decisions from there.
And that's smart. As it stands right now, the only new series they have debuted is Sword.
Right, right.
You know, everything else is a continuation of what they were already doing in the Cables, X-Factor, X-Force, etc.
So I think the big question, though, is what do you think? Because I know you're a little bit harder on comics. You're a little bit longer, you know, follower and reader of comics. So I really want to see what you have to think after all this.
From my point of view, it's tough because I read so much mutant comics, like mutant-related comics. I do X-Men, X-Force, Marauders, and X-Factor all together. And I think they eat up so much of my time. My comic reading time, and obviously you're like, oh, we'll just buy more comics, Kyle, who cares? But like, comics cost money, and like, I try to limit myself on the overall number of series that I read, and when basically everything Marvel I'm reading is X-Men or mutant-related, it gets a little dry, and I just want to like spice it up. So what I think is going to happen, it's really unfortunate, is I think I am going to drop X-Factor. I've liked the premise, and it has some interesting notes in that the team is different. It's a lot of mutants that I haven't normally read.
Sure.
Or historically read. But X-Men, I feel like I can't give it up. You know, they did enough with this event that I need to continue to follow X-Men. Also, I want to see what happens with Cyclops and kind of, is he going to reform the X-Men team?
Well, that too. Yeah,
yeah, like,
100%.
What's going to come out of that? X-Force has been the best book overall for me. Like, it just has, since the beginning, since the assassination of Xavier in issue one,
right,
to the CIA kind of secretive stories, to the art style, Benjamin Percy doing everything. I've really, really enjoyed it. So I feel like X-Force has earned my read. And then Marauders, there was a twist right before Ten of Swords.
Okay.
With the whole Sebastian Shaw and Kate Pryde murder and resurrection.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm like, oh my gosh, like they've got all these hooks in me that I can't just give up. So unfortunately, I think X-Factor is going to be the one that pays the price, just because as much as I want to read it, as much as I like the premise, I need to make room for other comics that are coming down the line.
Yeah.
And kind of looking over to the DC side of things, Future State looks somewhat interesting. And Nightwing looks like he's going to get returned in March with Tom Taylor.
Very cool.
So I think I need to make space for that. And unfortunately, somebody's got to take a hit. And I do think it's going to be X-Factor. But in the end, I'm still going to be reading three mutant-related books. So how much am I really giving up?
Well, and that might be the play, too, is maybe I'll pick up a different book if I'm feeling the first couple issues are looking good. We'll mix it up, follow some different stuff, but still follow what's going on with all of mutant kind. So I think that it was really cool to see, and it had us twists and turns. It's a show of good writing, you know, in a way, even though it felt dull at times, they knew what they had coming for us, and they really gave us some good payoffs in the end. So it's been a blast following through from House and Powers through Dawn of X to this point. We've been chronicling it all along, and this was, you know, a really big moment for that. So super pumped that it ultimately does have us both wanting to continue on, at least for the next, you know, foreseeable future with the X-Men, and then we'll have to go from there. So hit us up on social media if you've been reading X of Swords. Let us know what you thought, whether you liked it, whether you agree with what we had to say. And if you're going to be continuing to follow the X-Men, let us know, as we may continue to do so as well on future chapters of Geek Ketchup. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this chapter, be sure to hit the subscribe button to get new chapters of Geek Ketchup every 2 weeks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Be sure to follow the show on social media, and you can find us on Facebook and YouTube at Geek Ketchup Podcast, or on Twitter and Instagram at Geek Ketchup Pod. Links to all these accounts are in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.